So we'll be bringing you back to the topic of yesterday, the mini time machine. And just to refresh you on why you care, they talked a lot yesterday about the difficulties of modeling particle acceleration at collisionless shocks and determining how ions and electrons are going to be heated, especially the electrons. Don spoke about cosmic ray acceleration. Anything that happens in cosmic ray acceleration will have impacts on the thermal populations as well. And Parviz spoke yesterday extensively about optical and UV results they had gotten, and I will be concentrating on X-ray observations. So they provide a complementary view of the shock that you can then compare with UV and optical. Generally, what you're usually measuring in the X-rays is going to be electron temperature, and the most straightforward thing that you're measuring in the UV and optical would be the proton and ion temperatures from line widths. You need both CCD observations and grating spectra, or you would like both, because the CCD observations allow you to separate portions behind the shock and study the evolution of the parameters behind the shock so that you can try to back out what was the electron temperature initially. But the high spectral resolution also will allow you to get a better precise determination on the thermodynamic state, on the ionization from the relative line fluxes. And you can sometimes also get broadening in the HETG and other grating spectra. So if there are two messages that I want you to get out of this talk, first, when interpreting X-ray spectra, you cannot assume that the electron temperature is the temperature of the shock. Unless you know that it's that old and that dense, don't do it. And the other thing that you'll be seeing over the talk, and I want you to evaluate for yourself what the strength of this relation is what we have been seeing is an inverse correlation of electron heating and shock speed. Now, as Parviz mentioned, this is offset in Mach number from the solar relation. But I would like to point out something that should be obvious, which is that if you have any heating process, it's going to have a range of Mach numbers, a range of plasma beta that it is effective over. All that a falling efficiency of electron heating means is that whatever was heating the electrons at 300 kilometers per second is no longer effective. It doesn't necessarily mean that it was the same process as when you got an inverse correlation in the solar data. You would like it if it were that simple, but it's not. You got to look for more than that. Okay, so ideally we'd measure the shock velocity independently by measuring the expansion of the shock for a known distance. We want to measure the electron temperature, the proton temperature, all the ion temperatures, and get an idea of the relativistic electron synchrotron radiation all the way up through the gamma rays. Now, as far as measuring temperatures, there are three basic methods. You can measure the thermal broadening of a line. And when you're looking at that, you should keep in mind that the bulk velocity and potentially the geometry of the shock, depending on what you're looking at, will factor into that line broadening. The next thing you can do is to measure the ratio of two lines. And the idea is that each of those lines has an exciting particle that is exciting it, and their relative ratios tells you something about the underlying particle distributions of the things exciting that line. But unless you're lucky enough, and there are some cases, unless you're lucky enough to be looking at the same ion of the same element, then you do have to put in knowledge of the ion fractions or the relative abundances if you're doing it across species in order to interpret these. The third method for electron temperature measurements would be the thermal Bremsstrahlen continuum. Now, what Parviz was alluding to is that you will get thermal Bremsstrahlen emission as long as those electrons are hot. So you will see thermal Bremsstrahlen at a reasonable distance from the shock. and you need to deduce what the initial electron temperature was. Now, conveniently, the Coulomb equilibration and the ionization are all happening on the same time scale. They're all determined by the product of the density and the time. So if you feel you can do the NEI stuff right, then you can deduce the initial electron temperature using your ionization state. The other issue that you're going to have is distinguishing it from other sources of continuum, especially in cosmic ray dominated shocks. You know the synchrotron, but actually trying to get just the thermal portion is going to be very difficult. You need deep spectra and more information if you can get it. So this is just a table basically summarizing that. So what do we have? I will be talking about each of these individually, but we basically see for the ratio of electron to proton temperatures, I can actually use it, electron to proton temperatures as a function of shock speed, we see a decreasing ratio from them being equilibrated at about 300 kilometers per second towards them being totally unequilibrated just at their mass ratios out here at 3,000 or more kilometers per second. The error bars that are on here, the larger error bars are error bars that I put on there. The smaller error bars are the error bars that are listed in the abstracts. The larger error bars are what you would get if you look at the conclusion sections and pulled it all together. So Parviz spoke a little bit about the Cygnus loop yesterday. This is just recent work by Levinson and Graham. Here's a ROSAT mosaic of Cygnus loop, and this region right here is blown up here with a Chandra X-ray image. You may or may not be able to see, but there actually is X-ray emission all the way out to there. So the shock front is out here, not that bright thing. So, and just to prove that to you, the H-alpha image shows you where the shock front is, defines it very well. And so you do know how far you are away from the shock. So if you lay down regions behind the shock and try to measure the evolution of the electron temperature, what they found is that closest to the shock, they're already getting a temperature of about, you know, 0.135 keV, and it only increases to 0.165. Now, if there were no collisionless heating whatsoever, then the outermost region, that the inner portion of that should be already at 0.05 keV, not this hot. And so the authors conclude that it's inconsistent with no electron heating, and that's absolutely reasonable and true. But so what they suggest is that you can get this kind of decrease just by having a small density contrast and slowing the shockwave down. So it doesn't take that much of a contrast to slow your shock from something with a temperature of 0.165 to 0.135. And so one would like to take these and say, what's the lowest electron temperature you possibly could have started with in order to get this? But given that you can get the same type of relationship with a deceleration, which if you look, it's obviously interacting with some interesting CSM on this side, not totally implausible, you might not want to push the data that hard, especially with that kind of photon statistics. So DML71 is a beautiful type 1A remnant in the LMC. And you can see it in the X-rays and in H-alpha, but it's very faint in the radio. It being very faint in the radio is actually a good thing in this case, because what that's probably indicating is that cosmic ray acceleration isn't efficient there. You can hope for that. And then that'll give you a baseline to compare against when you do have cosmic ray efficient shocks. So the other convenient thing is it's oblong. And there are, you know, the shocks up here, there is actually a shock up here, you can see it in H alpha, the shocks up here are indeed faster than the ones on the side. And that difference is consistent with just them running into different densities. So in one object, you can measure the electron to proton temperature ratio as a function of shock speed. So optically, we can measure the proton temperature at the shock. Parviz talked about this with the H alpha lines. And then the X-ray, we take progressive regions behind the shock. And in order to actually fit for the initial electron to proton temperature ratio, it is very useful that we have a proton temperature. Because then you can set your proton temperature to one thing and then just fit for the electron temperature to proton temperature ratio. And we did that within the range of allowed proton temperatures. And this is what we got with the first results were in black. The problem that we have is that X-rays are always complicated. And if you do not know the abundances, then they can mislead you in terms of the temperature. They can pull you off the actual temperature. And in the, originally, we had to basically find an average abundance set and use it everywhere. With our new deeper data, we can fit for the abundances just in that region, so we're not being biased by multi-temperature fits somewhere else, and obtain a more reliable result. So our first new result, of course, we went for the one that's neither fully nor minimally equilibrated first. First result is shown here in blue. You'll see that the errors haven't gotten any better, but I will be taking new proton temperatures in the end of this month, which is about half that error bar. So Tycho supernova remnant, a number of people have talked about. The point is that, okay, we think this is synchrotron emission, but you can still get an upper limit of what the electron temperature is by assuming it's thermal emission, and then compare that to the shock speed in order to get a measure of the electron to temperature ratio. And basically, you're getting an upper limit on it, because if this is synchrotron, then the thermal portion has to be even cooler. So I'm not going to go through those. Parviz talked about things like that. And what you get is originally you get an electron to proton temperature ratio of between 0.03 and 0.1, or less than this if all of that is synchrotron emission. And many people have pointed out this is a shock where we strongly believe that it has been modified by cosmic ray acceleration. SN1006 is a beautiful, beautiful remnant, partially because it's what we know the most about. And in terms of this question. So from four different lines of evidence, from optical, mostly from optical and UV, but I'm drawing your attention to the X-ray one since that's the subject of this talk. We see fully unequilibrated shocks, and this is that the ion-ion equilibration has been not effective, as well as the electron-ion equilibration. So we get electron to proton temperature ratios of 0.03 if you're doing it with the helium ratios, line ratios, and Yako got a oxygen line width of 530, which you can translate into an electron to proton temperature ratio of 0.05 approximately. 1987A, people were talking about this earlier, and now we can talk about it in detail. Well, sort of. This is a beautiful picture of it in the whole LMC. And these are the Chandra X-ray images of it after they've been deconvolved. So I'm just going to talk about the first grading spectrum that was taken. Because the first grading spectrum that was taken when the shock was still just hitting the ring. So you hope that you have a fairly simple situation. You don't have, you haven't generated all these extra shocks yet. The problem is it's not deep enough. So what they had to do was first make a composite average line that was built up from all the different, I believe, just the hydrogen-like species. And then, so first of all, you can't do it ion by ion. But then, since you aren't resolving, since you aren't resolving 1987A on the ATGG, you have to take into account the fact that you're looking at the bulk velocity and the width of the object. So they made arguments along the basis of the fact that if, if everything was equilibrated, then you would have needed a faster shock speed to get that electron temperature, or faster shock speed in order to maintain that ion temperature. And so you would get a huge contribution from the bulk motion, and you get these sharp portions on the spectrum. If there is no temperature equilibration, then you have a slower shock and you have a smaller proportion being due to the bulk motion, and you get a smoother curve. And what they found was that they found a shock speed of 3,400 kilometers per second plus or minus 700. And if you choose 3,500, then you get an electron-proton temperature ratio of 0.11. And on my graph, I filled that in too. So, EO102. In EO102, what I want to draw your attention to, what most people are studying or looking at, is this bright ring of ejecta and, you know, what could be Raleigh-Taylor fingers or stuff out here, certainly from due to the shock interaction for some reason. What we wanted to look at was this very outer shock. And it's not really pretty in all parts of the remnant. So we were just looking over here. But use the very outer shock of EO102 to measure the electron to proton temperature ratio. And using an expansion measurement to measure the shock speed, since you know it's in the SMC, you know how far away it is. from Rosat and Einstein, this is how much we believe the whole thing has expanded, which at the shock front would apply a speed of about 6,000 kilometers per second. This is plus or minus 2,000 by our estimate. When we look at the spectrum, so here's the blast wave, and this is the ejector spectrum with a beautiful oxygen in it. When we look at the spectrum, we only get an electron temperature of less than 1 keV, firmly less than 1 keV. But if it were going this quickly, or rather, if it were going 4,000 kilometers per second, and you allowed it to adiabatically expand, and you allow for the, and then you also have to allow for the contribution from the Coulomb collisions over that time, so it's not going to be at its initial electron temperature, and you know, you do see ions, lines emitting, so you know it has had some time, some NET has passed, then you get a minimum of an electron temperature of 2.5. So, you need the shock speed, you need the shock energy to be going into a portion of the particles that the electrons are not interacting with and can't take energy from. So we inferred that you require efficient cosmic ray production in order to explain this temperature difference. If it does have efficient cosmic ray acceleration, then actually 1 keV can be totally reasonable. And in fact, a proton temperature of 1 keV could be totally reasonable. So if you have cosmic ray acceleration and you haven't separately measured the proton temperature, then all of phase space is available for the electron-proton temperature ratio. But I believe it would be more fully equilibrated. So here are our final results. RCW86, Parviz talked about yesterday, and we do have reasonably, we do see a decrease of the efficiency of whatever was heating the electrons here as you increase in shock velocity. But you do want to take, well, and these, so the proton to ion temperatures and the ion widths here are also consistent with here full equilibration and here almost fully unequilibrated. Now, that's not actually something you expect, because there's the what's heating the ions, the instabilities that affect the ions are not going to be the same instabilities that affect the electrons. So, you know, that you have close to equilibration in the ions should not imply that you have close to equilibration in the electrons. So take that for whatever you want. But in any case, this is the region where all the activity is happening, where that instability is turning off. And at the moment, we have RCW86 and DML71 in that region, and that's all we have at the moment. But I'll be working on all of those points. And I just want to remind you that, okay, you have low equilibration for these shocks, but if you have efficient cosmic ray acceleration and you haven't separately measured the proton temperature and the electron temperature, then all of these can fly up there. If you haven't separately determined the ion temperature and you're literally comparing that to the electron temperature, then these could be fully equilibrated, just like EO102 is possible to be fully equilibrated. Now, some of these actually are tied down here, but, you know, you don't, it's not a cut and dry thing. Thank you.
I have one to start off with. In one EO102, you said the shock velocity is 6,000 kilometers per second determined from proper motions. Now, it's running into a stellar wind. Suppose that stellar wind is running away from the shock at 1 or 2,000 kilometers per second, so your shock velocity is actually lower. Would that be more consistent with...
Well, you have to get it pretty low.
Yeah, I mean, how low does it have to go to mean that you don't need to invoke cosmic rays?
To get to 1 kV...
You had a range of 2.5.
Yeah, 2.5.
So you need a factor of 2 or more in electron temperature.
Right. You have one thing that's working against you as you have... No. In that case, it's not working against you. Sorry. I'll talk about something else in a minute. But... Yeah, offhand, I don't know exactly.
Something like 4,000 kilometers per second would bring it.
4,000 is the 2.5 number.
Oh, I see.
So 4,000. See, we can take off 2,000 kilometers per second. Fine.
Okay, so you can take off a bit more than 2,000.
So we can take off. You know, I'm not sure we can't do it with 3,000. There is a new result on EO102, HST, published very recently, and I forget who's the lead author on it. Of the optical expansion, and they're finding very interesting results that we will have to work on.
That's why you have this.
Yes. That we'll have to work on figuring out. They get an expansion center down in this portion, and expansion velocity is faster up here, and the expansion velocity that they have here. The velocity that implies for up here would then only be 3,000 kilometers per second. I believe that with all the Chandra calibration observations that have been taken, we should be able to watch just this shock itself move. And it's difficult, but it's certainly not impossible. One other thing, totally unpublished, but done by an REU student who is not related to me, but his last name is Rutkowski. So he found that there was actually faster velocities down here if you looking at the X-rays. So, and he found more stuff extending off of these. So take that for what you will. But I think that you're going to have problems reconciling the X-rays and the optical for a little while.
Oh, Southland.
I don't know if you have you read the thing at all where they have the different probabilities like the optical objective and they get an expansion velocity 2,000 kilometers per second in the objective?
Right, that's the one I was just referring to.
Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, it's 2,000 for the ejecta, which out there then translates to 3,000. I believe.
You just mentioned that there's X-ray emission below in the south.
Yeah.
Isn't that an X-ray image?
Yeah, this is an X-ray image.
All right, so where's the X-ray emission to the south?
I'm not sure how much further it moved out, but he has X-ray emission about out here.
Okay.
Just a little bit further than what we see.
Okay. So is the velocity the only factor on which this depends? You showed the plot of electron ion collision with velocity, but suppose, I mean, I could have two remnants where they reach the same velocity, but they're expanding in a different medium at different times.
Yeah.
Does that
It is absolutely not the only factor that's going to go into these instabilities. It isn't.
No, but the plot looked quite nice
right.
with just the velocity, and I was quite surprised
nice.
That...
Oh, wrong direction. The plot does look quite nice. But actually, I think a lot of the interesting things are going to come from determining exactly how far away from minimal equilibration these fast ones are. Because some of them, their error bars give them as already being, they can't just be their mass ratio. There has to be some amount of collisionless heating. So I think you may actually get some interesting results from down there. Because you know that the plasma beta and the density gradient of the medium, these things have to matter.
Yeah, the reason I was asking was, like, if I take just this plot, and suppose I run some simulation and I have a remnant and I find a shock going and so, can I just take a number off of here, say my shock is 2,500, so this is the equilibration? I doubt it, right?
Or,
but it looks pretty clean.
People have,
the way that
which is not necessarily a good thing, but it gets me citations. and the thing is, the reason you want this is exactly for that reason. Because if you knew that when your shock has slowed down to 300 kilometers per second, it's fully equilibrated, and you know that it doesn't start being equilibrated at all until it gets to at least 5,000 kilometers per second, that's great. Because you can fold that into your hydrodynamical simulations, and that would be useful. But I would not do that with this yet. Parviz would say, go try it. And, you know, but you do have I wouldn't work so hard on folding it into your hydrodynamical models yet. The use of it that some people have found in recent papers saying, oh, well, our shock is 700 kilometers per second, so we really shouldn't be considering the limit of the velocity that we get using minimal equilibration. We should really only be considering the velocities that we get assuming a slightly higher equilibration.
Right.
Things like that, plausibility arguments, as long as you've said the other, what the full extent is, I think are worth saying, setting out.
You don't have any case where you have like two velocities from different remnants, but they show, I mean, the same velocity, similar, but they show completely different equilibration. There's,
no. Okay. I mean, RCW 86 and DML 71 is going to be good bets for trying to do that.
Plot up there. I wanted to add a little bit. The controlling parameter is most likely to be the Alphane Mach number. Okay. There's a plot very similar to this in the solar wind. You see low velocity. Low velocity or low Mach number shocks have high electron heating. High Mach number is low electron heating. In the solar wind, this corresponds to an Alphane Mach number of about 25, which is found at the outer planets as a SolarWind shot goes out to Uranus or so. If you want to map the supernova remnant shocks onto the solar wind shocks, you've got to wind up the pre-shock magnetic field to get a mapping from, to make this a Mach number of 20, an Alphane Mach number of 25, you need to significantly increase what we think, the magnetic field ahead of the shock. So maybe we have some circumstantial evidence for the Bell-Lutyak or cosmic ray amplification process. One thought that I think is something that's crying out for someone to do is to take the blast wave in the Cassiopeia VLP, measure the magnetic field or estimate the magnetic field from the width of the synchrotron rim. You can measure the electron temperature behind the shock, and it's out in this range of the plot, and just see if you can make any sense of the numbers that come out of that.
Okay, Carl. Like to mention a slightly unrelated but certainly connected thing in the simulation I showed earlier on. I did include collisionless electron heating at the reverse shock. And in order to explain the iron K alpha flux and the fact that the iron K alpha flux peaks interior to iron L in the Tycho supernova element, it is necessary to include collisionless electron heating at the reverse shock. And the range of parameters, it has to be higher than 0.01 but lower than 0.1.
Okay, Misha. One of your statements regarding this low electron temperature as an indication of acceleration efficiency, high efficiency of proton acceleration, how can you rule out the adiabatic interaction of electrons with the shock wave, because the protons are clearly heated by some instability generated by protons, but these waves are too long for electrons, and
right.
Electrons are strongly magnetized in this environment, and they just pass along the field lines and are not terribly affected by this kind of
turbulence. So you would have them be completely
you can still have cold electrons in
you
perfectly
can,
unmodified
the is,
shock.
The problem is we actually can't measure the electron temperature at the very shock front. We're measuring it behind the shock front after there has been some Coulomb equilibration.
Oh, yeah.
So you're going to get
How do you know? Is it collisional? It's still collisionless shock?
It's collisionless, but you
but the turbulence is too long for this electron. They can live forever in this kind of environment, unless you have
right.
any
but
other.
But the density is such, you know, if you do the volume and you do the density, it you will get some collisions between where the shock front is and the end. You, if
at
you didn't
distance.
Get any, yeah, uh-huh. If you didn't get any collisions, then you also wouldn't be seeing these ions.
You can make a shock work if the ions are deflected by the shock, and the electrons go where they need to go to neutralize space charge. Yeah. You don't need a specific electron wave, but they just need to neutralize the space charge that would happen. If yeah.